Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving deep into the most critical insights from the world of venture capital. Our material for this deep dive is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, based on the most relevant posts on LinkedIn about venture capital in calendar weeks 27 and 28. That's late June and early July. And Frenis, just so you know, is a B2B market research company. They work with enterprises to optimize their campaigns using account and executive insights, really going far beyond what AI alone can do. So if you're a professional in M&A, private equity consulting, or maybe just fascinated by the strategic shifts in investments, well, this deep dive is definitely for you. We're going to unpack the top venture capital trends we've seen across LinkedIn over the past fortnight or so.
That's right. Think of this deep dive as your strategic shortcut.
Yeah.
We've basically distilled the key nuggets about things like capital discipline, founder maturity, and innovative fund models. It's all straight from the leading voices in the ecosystem. So you should walk away with a clear, pretty concise picture of what truly matters in VC right now.
All right, let's kick things off then. Our first big theme. The overarching macro trends and the, you know, the shifting landscape in venture capital, the consensus on LinkedIn seems really clear. There's a new, sharp focus on capital discipline. This idea that raising money is no longer the default option.
Mm-hmm.
It's really front and center.
It's a significant pivot, isn't it? I mean, the venture capital trends. A Fortnite in review summary really highlighted this. Startups are being urged towards, you know, lean operations, preserving optionality rather than just chasing these huge, often dilutive funding rounds. It's such a contrast to the old growth at all costs thinking.
Yeah, definitely. And we're already seeing some fascinating real world examples. Mm-hmm. Louis Gleason pointed to Elon Musk channeling, what, $2 billion from Tesla directly into XAI. That's not your typical VC backing at all. It's like a new playbook where corporate money just replaces the VCs, cuts out the outside influence, the board pressure, gives him full control. It's about strategic independence.
Exactly. And Marco Dewey expanded on this too, suggesting that not raising funds can actually be a powerful driver for innovation. It forces teams into like sharper product market alignment, more efficient solutions. He even mentioned using AI agents instead of hiring. It's this kind of lean, self-sufficient growth. Some people are calling it the seed strapping era, you know, where that initial seed funding is used so well, you don't need endless follow-ons.
That reframes everything, doesn't it? It fits perfectly with what Ty Crandall said, pretty bluntly, actually. Raising more money isn't a strategy, it's a tactic. He argued it doesn't fix broken business models, just adds pressure. So the takeaway seems to be growth should be capital efficient, not just, you know, capital dependent.
Which brings us right into that unicorn versus zebra debate. It feels like it's gaining steam again. Susanna Moore made a really strong case for writing a zebra, building businesses that are profitable and purpose-driven, sustainable, impactful. It sort of shifts the focus from just these inflated valuations to, well, long-term meaningful value.
And that idea resonates globally, too. Clinton Nokai, talking about the African startup scene, believes the region needs way more zebras than unicorns. He shared this great example of a supposedly small fintech, processed over 500 million naira, created jobs, helped the unbanked. That's real tangible impact, right? Not just some number on paper.
Oh, definitely. And for a really striking example of this new thinking, Chase Diamond shared a story about an AI founder. Raised capital once, used AI to scale super efficiently, became profitable quickly, and then, get this, rejected over 100 VCs who came knocking later. That just perfectly embodies that seed-stracking ideal.
So what does this all mean for you listening, whether you're a founder, investor, advisor? Peter Corbell has some really vital wisdom here. Mm-hmm. Not every business needs investors. You need to really get your head around your specific business type. Is it traditional, a scalable small business, a fast-growth startup? That dictates if, when, and how much you should raise. It's all about deep strategic clarity.
Okay, switching gears a bit now. Let's talk about fundraising strategy and what investors are, well, really expecting in this new climate. The consensus seems to be that raising capital needs to be treated like a rigorous, almost scientific process, not just, you know, reacting when you're running out of cash.
This is where it gets really tactical, I think. Jenny Fielding had some amazing insights. She said successful fundraising really hinges on radical operational transparency, candor, and real team cohesion during due diligence. He talked about founders running glass box operations, basically operating with total transparency, proactively sharing everything, even like learnings from customers they lost, and showing the team is completely aligned. That's how you build serious trust.
Absolutely. And Menabotrust takes it even further. He details how to turn fundraising into a science. His steps include finding your startup twin, another company with a similar journey, learn what worked for them, analyzing your own past successes, leading with asymmetric upside.
What exactly does that mean, asymmetric upside?
It's basically showing the investor how the potential return vastly outweighs the perceived risk, making it seem like a no-brainer almost, and then packaging your whole pitch like a product, making it super easy for investors to say yes. It's all about meticulous preparation.
That's a ton of prep before you even walk in the door.
Yeah.
Costa Mishra kind of reinforces this, right?
Yeah.
Advising founders to nail product market fit before focusing on fundraising. He says, ask yourself the hard questions like, why do I really need funding right now?
And, you know, speaking of getting in the door, Tindy Adakai gave a pretty stark warning. Never send your pitch to a VC via form or generic inbox.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about the terrible success rate, how jaded VCs get. Warm intros even now are just crucial for cutting through all that noise.
Right. Okay, moving on to later stages then.
Mm-hmm.
Marie Aureli Rigaudin notes that getting Series A funding, it's a whole new game.
Mm-hmm.
It demands consistent traction, clear revenue growth, and a team that can actually execute at scale. It's not just about potential anymore. It's about proven performance and a clear way forward.
Yeah, and Sam Lee Chingity has a really crucial point about the financial models at Series A. VCs aren't just judging your numbers. He says they're judging how you think, how clear your assumptions are, how well you understand the levers driving your growth. That's paramount. It's really a test of your strategic thinking.
Ultimately, like Enrico Baldessari put it so well, capital is leverage. So securing the right funding at the right time is just critical for sustainable strategic growth. Okay, now let's try and navigate the often murky waters of startup valuation and these changing founder dynamics. This area has seen a lot of shifts and pretty spirited debate lately.
Yeah, what's really thought-provoking here is Stephen Millard's point that founder experience can be overrated. He argued it's not always a predictor of future success.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, maybe, it might even lead to overconfidence or, you know, resistance to fresh ideas.
That is provocative, isn't it? But then you have Mike Schatzman offering a sort of contrasting view. He says he now evaluates VC deals by trusting his gut, looking for founders who've been tested, not just lucky, and prioritizing strong operational instincts over just big market size numbers. Sounds like a mix of experience and maybe a deeper, more intuitive feel for leadership.
And if you connect that to valuing early stage companies, Alejandro Cremades, drawing from Lorenzo T. Gerassi's guide, really emphasizes that it's much more art than science. Key things are understanding that inverse link between risk and return, how critical market timing is, and focusing on growing the enterprise value, not just obsessing over dilution.
We've also seen so much talk about what Sebastian Becker called the AI valuation distortion. You know, AI startups raising at 100x revenue multiples or, incredibly, without even having a product yet, is creating these hugely inflated expectations. Alessandro Lazzaro even coined a term for it, vibe valuing, where VCs just conjure up these massive valuations based more on hype or vibe than solid metrics like ARR. It definitely feels like a bit of a Wild West out there.
It really does. And Rafik Farr provided some actual data showing a stark difference geographically. U.S. startup valuations are significantly higher than in emerging markets, like Carta's Q1 2025 median seed valuation in the U.S., $16 million. It just underscores the different market dynamics and, frankly, access to capital around the world.
And for many founders, there's this common, often unexpected reality Chris Cunningham discussed, the Delta round. That extra funding needed between seed and Series A. It's becoming the norm, not the exception. It's not always a smooth jump anymore. Founders need to plan for these kinds of intermediary steps.
Yeah, exactly. And to help founders deal with all this complexity, some practical tools are popping up. Chris Topman, for instance, shared an Excel template using the VC method, that common framework VCs use for valuing early stage companies. And Nevena Miskovich offered a broader valuation bundle just to help founders really get inside the heads of investors and understand how they approach these crucial financial calculations.
All right, moving into our next theme, let's explore the structural shifts and the evolving models within the venture capital industry itself. It's not just startups changing. The investors and their whole strategies are adapting too.
What's really intriguing here, I thought, was Mirto Lalakos's advice. Kind of counterintuitive. Smaller is better for new VC fund managers. The idea is it lets them build a track record faster, gain trust with smaller LPs. You know, the investors in the VC funds makes it easier to raise that first fund.
Oh, interesting. And Carlos Trench's Sons de la Maza dove into that intensifying access versus ownership debate in early stage VC. Basically, do you invest widely for early access or focus on bigger ownership stakes in fewer companies. Mm-hmm. You mentioned funds like Masi are embracing the access model, broader portfolios, collaborative syndication, focusing on getting in early and managing liquidity later through secondary markets. It's a different way to play.
Corporate venture capital, CVCs, they're also playing a bigger, more nuanced role now. Jingji's Founders Playbook helps founders understand CVC structures, typical check sizes, and crucially, how they can be a bridge to the bigger corporate business units, offering way more than just cash.
Which raises a key question for founders, right? How do you know if a CVC is the right partner for you? David Cruz E. Silva, referencing Nicole LeBlanc from Woven Capital, highlighted three signs a CVC is worth having on your cap table. Things like deep technical expertise, access to real-world scale through the parent company, and genuine long-term strategic alignment.
Interestingly, Adeo Ressi noted recently how VC investment itself is becoming more accessible. He revealed that 75% of LP investments are now actually below 150K. That signals a shift away from just huge institutional money towards more distributed opportunity, attracting more high net worth individuals, family offices.
This next point really pulls back the curtain on the industry, I think. Ivan Landabasso summarized Bill Gurley's recent clinic on the state of VC. Gurley, who's a legendary VC, argued that mega funds broke the system, that there are 1,000 plus zombie unicorns out there, billion-dollar companies that are basically dead, can't raise more, or exit profitably. He also thinks the IPO window is shut, partly because private markets just got too good, and that AI reset the cycle with a fresh wave of FOMO, that fear of missing out, driving new capital. Wow, heavy stuff. And as Andrew Matuszak discussed, you've even got potential legislative changes like the DEAL Act on the horizon that could reshape the whole VC landscape, signaling ongoing regulatory interest in how this all works. Okay, finally, let's touch on the often unseen difficulties and the real human toll of the fundraising journey. It's definitely not always as glamorous or easy as the headlines make it seem.
No, not at all. Hitch and Murad put it really well, talking about the real difficulties of raising capital. He described it as a full-time job on top of your actual job. He emphasized the endless rejections, the huge mental toll, but also noted that ultimately it builds incredible resilience.
Leon Eisen's 17 mindset shifts for fundraising had some really valuable nuggets too. He cited entrepreneurs like Tony Say, whose advice was, chase the vision, not the money. It's about getting your own head right first, isn't it? Because the external challenges are just massive.
Absolutely. And Mohit Gulati's summary of the whole founder-investor journey through all its phases, it highlights this one non-negotiable truth. The only thread that keeps this marriage intact is trust and truthfulness. Mm. Without that foundation, the partnership almost always falls apart. It's fundamental.
That really resonates with Rose Francis' point, too, that fundraising isn't fuel, it's leverage. Smart founders, she says, optimize for deep alignment with investors, not just the highest valuation. They protect their control, their core vision. It's about building real strategic partnerships that actually move your mission forward.
And sadly, persistent issues around access and inclusion are still a major challenge. Stella Alexandrova found that for women-led startups, the problem isn't talent, it's access. Sam Adekunle mentioned the UK government's $500 million initiative aimed specifically at supporting diverse fund managers and founders, which is a start, and Thalia B's 2025 State of Black Venture Report. It highlights ongoing gender disparities, with Black women still less likely to hold senior VC roles. Despite performance indicators, there's still a long way to go.
Geography plays such a powerful role, too. Haley Jones's data showed that where you raise capital matters more than you think. The Bay Area still just dominates late-stage funding, capturing something like 53% of Series C rounds. Huge concentration.
We also saw specific sector challenges mentioned, like for music tech, which Jacob Redstrom explored. And Patrick Hipsher pointed out a really interesting structural challenge, funding regenerative businesses. There's often a mismatch between typical VC fund timelines and, well, nature's much slower regeneration cycles. How do you reconcile those?
Steve Blank kind of brings it all back to a core message for founders, though. VCs are looking for extraordinary businesses that can generate extraordinary returns, not just good businesses.
Yeah.
He really emphasizes that you have to understand their financial model, what truly drives their investment decisions.
And one last crucial warning from Alex Pattis about those VC term sheet traps. These seemingly innocent clauses can apparently devastate founder outcomes, even if the company exits successfully, costing founders millions. It just underscores how vital it is to scrutinize every single detail and really truly understand what you're signing.
Phew, okay, that was a lot. If you enjoy this deep dive, remember, new deep dives drop every 2 weeks. We encourage you to also check out our other editions where we plunge into private equity, M&A, and strategy and consulting. Thanks so much for tuning into The Deep Dive. This landscape is always evolving, and staying informed is probably your greatest asset. So consider this. In an era where capital efficiency and long-term vision seem paramount, what's maybe one immediate shift you can make in your own strategic approach, either to capital or to growth? Think about it. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss our next exploration into the world of business insights.